Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
All right, folks, takeaway time for May 2nd, 2019. Barr says thank you next to testifying before the House Judiciary.
But when push comes to shove, the administration cannot dictate the terms of our hearing in our hearing room.
And we drop some historical knowledge that helps us understand the recent congressional spectacles. Also on the show, should gig economy workers be treated like employees? The federal government just indicated no.
I feel as if this app is my employer and I should have protections under federal labor laws and under state labor laws.
And a sports court decided that pro track athlete Caster Semenya cannot compete internationally because her natural testosterone is higher than most women.
This has always been a fight when it comes to women's sports, as far as who gets to be a woman and then what it means to not be enough of a woman.
All right, let's get it going.
Attorney General Barr has just informed us that he will not attend tomorrow's hearing.
Attorney General William Barr is refusing to testify before the House Judiciary Committee today about the Mueller report. The Department of Justice announced the news on Wednesday evening after Attorney General Barr had spent the day being alternately grilled by Democrats and lauded by Republicans during his testimony before the Senate Judiciary.
Would you accept them recommending a charging decision to you if they had not reviewed the evidence?
Well, that's a question for Bob Mueller. He's the U.S. attorney.
And you slandered this man from top to bottom. So if you want more of this, you're not going to get it. If you want to ask him questions, you can't.
President essentially tries to change the lawyer's account in order to prevent criticism of himself.
Well, that's not a crime.
Thank you for agreeing to help restore the department's reputation as an impartial arbiter of the law.
Are the president's actions detailed in this report consistent with his oath of office and the requirement in the Constitution that he take care that the laws be faithfully executed?
Is what consistent with that?
But the reason Bill Barr is not here today is because the Democrats decided they didn't want him here today.
The administration cannot dictate the terms of our hearing in our hearing room.
The Democrats on the House Judiciary had wanted to bring in staff lawyers to question Barr, but the Justice Department said they objected to that format, which is rare, but does have precedent. Several Senate Democrats told Barr on Wednesday that he should resign over his handling of the release of the Mueller report. I have two voices with me to talk about Barr's refusal to testify and to give us some historical context on this moment. Chara Torres-Spellacy is a professor of law at Stetson University, and Quinta Jurecic is managing editor of Lawfare. So glad to have you both with us. Quinta, let's start with you. Big news yesterday from Attorney General Barr. What was his reason for not testifying?
Well, he felt that, you know, he'd sort of, it seems the way the Justice Department presented it, that he sort of said everything that he could have possibly said to the Senate and didn't really feel the need to be grilled again by the House of Representatives. And I think that's representative of the posture he really took before the Senate, where he seemed even contemptuous, I would say, of some of the Democratic questioning. And you can see why that sort of manifests in this refusal to come before the House today.
And Quinta, what message is this sending? What broader message could this be sending from the administration?
Again, I think contempt is a good word, you know. I think it's consistent with the administration's recent tactics of basically stonewalling and refusing to give the House anything at all. The message is really, you know, we don't accept your power as a coordinate branch of government. And I think that there are circumstances under which the attorney general might refuse to come testify that wouldn't send that message, perhaps. But along with his performance yesterday, which was really sort of sneering, I think that comes through loud and clear today.
Chara, we should note here that you are a former staffer for Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, but you have also studied constitutional law. I'm wondering, is there a historical precedent for this move by AG Barr?
Well, as I write in my new book, Political Brands, this administration is one of unreliable narrators, and Bill Barr has joined that group in full force, and you saw that in his testimony in the Senate yesterday. And I guess what I would say is Barr is like a chef that you catch in the bathroom who doesn't wash his hands. And after you see that, you don't want to eat what comes out of the kitchen. And except that the kitchen is now the Department of Justice. And so there are historical precedents of attorneys general stonewalling. For example, Nixon's attorney general, John Mitchell, had 3 days of testimony where he basically stonewalled, and it didn't go well for him. In the end, he was actually tried and convicted for obstruction of justice.
Could that be a scenario that happens here, Quinta?
In Barr's case, I will leave that to the historians. I will say that the House has been making noises about holding him in contempt of Congress. I would say I'm not sure if they'll follow through on that, just because the mechanics of how that works are actually pretty complicated. Namely, that when the House holds someone in contempt, it's usually, not always, the executive branch who has to enforce that. And if the Justice Department, you know, doesn't want to bring contempt proceedings against its own attorney general, it's not going to. So it gets pretty hairy pretty fast.
Chara, you've also, talking about the historical points here, you've also mentioned two specific moments in U.S. history. One was Watergate, and the second was, or should we say the first, was the Teapot Dome scandal of the 1920s. Doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, but remind us what happened in that scandal.
So in Teapot Dome, you had a Secretary of the Interior give a private company oil rights. The oil rights was in Teapot Dome, Wyoming, hence the name of the scandal. And it looks like that private entity gave the then Secretary of the Interior $100,000 for these privileges, which are on public lands and belong to the American people. And there were lots of different investigations into Teapot Dome that were done by Congress. And one of the questions was, how did the Secretary of the Interior become so rich so fast? And another side question was, why didn't Harding's attorney general prosecute the Secretary of the Interior? So it's not entirely analogous to our current situation, but one of the things that came out of Teapot Dome was a fight over getting the brother of the Harding attorney general to testify before Congress. And they actually sent out the sergeant at arms and arrested him in Ohio. And then he contests his arrest because he says, basically, Congress doesn't have the right to arrest me. And that goes up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court says, actually, Congress does have the right to arrest you if you refuse a lawful congressional subpoena to appear.
So in this case, I mean, I want to go back a little bit to the letter here that was initially at issue. Quinta, at one point yesterday, Barr referred to the letter as, quote, snitty, and he said he thinks it was, quote, written by one of Mueller's staff people. What was your take on Barr's characterization of that? Because one thing that keeps coming out is if Mueller wanted to communicate something to Barr, he could have easily done so without putting it in writing.
Exactly. And I think for that reason, it is notable that it was put in writing. And while I certainly wouldn't characterize it as snitty, and I don't think there's any need or any reason to think that it was written by a staff member, I think Barr may be responding to something there when he perhaps feels a little taken aback, perhaps, by that letter. If you read it, it reads as very polite. But in the context of sort of how things are done in the Department of Justice, to memorialize on paper your objections to functionally what Mueller's superior has done, done here is a really, really big step. It's especially a big step in this context because, you know, Barr and Mueller knew each other before this. Barr has described them as friends. And, you know, Mueller has been silent for this entire investigation. This is the first thing that we've seen from him that is not an indictment or a criminal complaint. And I think it really underlines how dissatisfied and perhaps disturbed Mueller was by how Barr handled the rollout of the report.
And we also, in talking about the rollout of the report and also just Barr's, Mueller's concern, the way Barr is characterizing Mueller's concerns, he's saying that it's primarily about how the media handled the summary. Shara, does that make sense to you?
Well, I have Mueller's letter in front of me, and this is not about the media getting it wrong. Mueller says to Barr, your four-page summary letter that Barr gave to Congress did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of this office, as in the special counsel's office, work and conclusions. And anyone who read the four-page Barr letter and then compared it to the actual 400-page Mueller report would agree with Mueller's assessment there. There was a huge difference between the four-page memo and the report, and it was not just a matter of length. It was a matter of substance. And one of the things that I think has been sort of misunderstood is why Bob Mueller did not indict Trump for obstruction of justice. And the reason that he gave in his own report is longstanding DOJ rules say that you cannot indict a sitting president. And I think Mueller, being a honorable person, did not want to accuse the president when that could not be resolved in a court of law where you'd have the adversarial process.
I want to focus a little bit on the Democrats here, because there is we've mentioned this yesterday on the show before the testimony, that there's a very contentious relationship here between Barr and congressional Democrats. What is how concerning should that be, Chara?
Well, I'm less concerned about, a reaction to the Democrats. I mean, I think it's sort of par for the course that the opposing party, when you have a congressional hearing, is going to be harder on you as a witness than the people on your own team.
Are they being hard enough?
I, of course, I no longer work for the Senate. That was 20 years ago. I think there are a certain number of steps that could be taken, which they are trying to do. They are trying to get a unredacted copy of the Mueller report. They're trying to get the president's taxes from the IRS. They're trying to get some of his bank transactions from Deutsche Bank. They're trying to get his accountants to give up what they have. And once you have all of that material in front of you, then you can make a sensible decision about, is impeachment the right next step?
Chara Torres-Pellacy is a professor of law at Stetson University, and Quinta Jurecic is managing editor of Lawfare. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so a lot of us have benefited from the so-called gig economy. Cars and food delivery and even housework, all on demand. For some Americans, these jobs are just a way to make some extra cash. But for others, gig economy jobs can be a main source of income. And that's where it gets tricky. You see, the big question is whether those workers should be considered employees with rights like minimum wage and overtime, or contract workers that are not covered by federal labor laws. On Monday, the Department of Labor released a letter giving us the most definitive answer yet. It told an unnamed gig economy company that it could call the people who work through its platform contract workers and not employees. Eric Morath is a labor economics and policy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And I asked him first off for a reminder, what is a gig economy company?
In some people's minds, it's really just Uber and Lyft and these sort of ride-hailing apps. The broader definition would be including, you know, anyone that's using a app or a website to obtain work. And that certainly could extend to things like Handy and TaskRabbit. And some people even would include things like Airbnb or Etsy that allow kind of regular folks to sell or rent property, you know, on the internet in a way they weren't really able to, you know, 5 or 10 years ago.
Are the folks who don't, for example, folks who do not work for Uber Inc., the company, but people who are actually doing the driving, for example, or if we're talking about a food delivery app, people who are actually doing the food delivery, what are they considered so far? And how did this letter from the Department of Labor change that?
Yeah, so for the most part, they've been considered independent contractors. And what this letter from the Department of Labor did was cement that in a more formal way. This letter was, if you read it closely, is certainly aimed at places like Handy or Angie's List. One of these companies, and we don't know which one, asked the Department of Labor, if in the future a complaint was brought against us for a minimum wage or overtime violation, could we be found to be this person's employer if the person's a painter or a dog walker or something like that? And the Labor Department said no, and they publicly issued that letter, so it sets an example that other companies could follow.
What's the difference here? I mean, I think a lot of us can assume what the differences are, but how does the Labor Department define the difference between someone who's an employee of an organization or a company and someone who's a contract worker?
Well, the big difference is whether or not you're protected by the Fair Labor Standards Act. And the Fair Labor Standards Act includes minimum wage and overtime rules. So if, say, you're a painter and you get paid $50 to do a job and that job takes you 10 hours to complete, if you're an independent contractor, well, you agreed to do the work for that amount of money and however long it took you. If you've got it done in an hour, you made $50 an hour. If you got it done in 10 hours, you made $5. Whereas if you're an employee, then it would be, well, hey, the minimum wage is $7.25, so you must be paid that minimum. So the employer would have to make up that difference or be in violation of the law.
Now, of course, we don't know, I should say, the name of the company that the Labor Department is referencing here. But I'm just curious, can you give us a sense of the lay of the land prior to this letter for workers in the quote-unquote gig economy? What were some of the big issues that a lot of these workers said that they wanted? Did many of them want to be contract employees? Or do many of them want to actually be employees of these organizations that they're gigging for?
I think it's a wide variety, right? There's certainly a lot of evidence that many people who work in the gig economy don't do it as a full-time job. They are doing it as sort of weekend warriors or to supplement income during a slow period at their main job. And so those people may be very comfortable being independent contractors, but you know, there is a group and there's been lawsuits filed that where people are seeking more of the protections of a traditional employee, saying, this is my main job. I feel as if this app is my employer and I should, you know, have protections under federal labor laws and under state labor laws.
So now, is this guidance that's been distributed so far legally binding? And if so, what does that mean for these workers going forward?
So it's not legally binding. It's one of the weakest forms of regulation here. So it's the Labor Department saying, if we're approached with a case like this, this is how we'd handle it. It doesn't mean that a worker or a group of workers couldn't file a lawsuit and a judge could say, you know, I'm setting aside that guidance. Also, because of the way this is done, and the Trump administration did this earlier in their term, it can be ripped up by the next president. They could issue a new opinion, or they could just say, well, we're not going to follow that old opinion because it doesn't have the same weight as a regulation and certainly far from a law.
And do gig economy companies benefit from having their workers designated as contract workers versus employees? And I'm going to imagine the answer here is yes, but you tell us.
Absolutely, they do. So if you had to follow minimum wage and overtime rules, well, what would that mean? It means you'd have to have a system to track hours and pay. And that is a big expense, right? I mean, there's not time clocks everywhere in the world for an Uber driver or a TaskRabbit laborer to check in on. So they'd have to develop technology tools. They'd have to have it audited. They'd have to employ a group of people to to manage that. Whereas now it's they're just sort of doing this matching and then can be hands off on is whether or not there were any labor law violations occurring.
What does this tell us about how the Department of Labor, at least under this current administration, is looking at the gig economy? I mean, does this portend a good future for folks working in this space who are doing these jobs as their main gig, if you will?
There's certainly been a clear shift in philosophy between the Obama administration and the Trump administration. So going back to the Obama administration, there was an effort to look very closely at people who were designated as independent contractors, not just gig workers in the narrow sense, but anyone who, you know, is getting a 1099 and that's how they're being paid and saying, hey, is that correct? Are they being classified correctly? And they made it clear they're taking a careful look. The Trump administration has moved in the opposite direction. It's part of their broader sort of hands-off approach. They say they don't want to stand in the way of a business being created or an employment opportunity being created. And they sent with this letter and other actions the message that, you know, the government isn't going to be taking a real careful look to see if we can apply this law to, you know, multiple different employers.
Eric Morath is a labor economics and policy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Eric, thanks so much.
Happy to join you.
Now to the sports world for a court ruling that could have major repercussions. South African Olympic champion runner Caster Semenya must lower her testosterone levels to compete in certain high-level races. That's the ruling this week from the Court of Arbitration for Sport. It said that Semenya's natural testosterone levels, which are higher than many female athletes, give her an unfair advantage. It's a battle Semenya and her supporters have been fighting for years, and the ruling came as a significant setback. Katie Barnes is with me. They're a sports and culture writer for ESPNW. Katie, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me back. Appreciate it.
So the ruling in this case was based on what exactly?
The ruling was based on oral arguments that were presented a couple months ago, where the IAAF presented their argument that Caster Semenya and athletes similarly situated to her have an unfair advantage given their levels of testosterone. And Caster's side argued that that's not true and that she doesn't have an unfair advantage and therefore these new regulations would be invalid and asked the court to throw them out.
So Caster is not doping. Her testosterone levels are natural. Why is a court ruling on her ability to compete? Why? When did this even become an issue? I mean, how did we get here?
Oh, how we got here is a very long and complicated question. But to be as succinct as possible, this has always been a fight when it comes to women's sports, as far as who gets to be a woman and what it means to be womanly, and then what it means to not be enough of a woman. This goes back to any kind of discussion that folks will use shorthand. They'll just say, well, you know, East Germany in the 80s, as far as like women who are participating in doping, right? So sex testing and gender verification has always underscored the existence of women's sports, especially at the elite level. And it's packaged as a means to keep the integrity of women's sports intact, to make sure that there isn't a man competing amongst women, right? And so that is the short answer of how we got here for Caster specifically. Since she won the world championships in the 800 meter in 2009, this has been a problem for her. She was immediately forced to undergo sex verification by the IAAF that year and has been competing against women in perpetuity since that time.
What's Caster's response been so far? I mean, does she have options to continue competing? And if so, what are they?
So she has a couple of options. Her response, though, to be honest, has been muted on Twitter. She's just kind of posted a few quotes basically saying sometimes the best reaction is no reaction. Her camp can appeal to a Swiss court, a higher Swiss court. I do not know if they will. They have not said specifically if that is something they will do. They have 30 days to decide that. If that is not the case, Caster has a couple of options should she want to remain competing. One of them is to be compliant with the new regulations that the IAAF will institute, which would require her to lower her testosterone levels to 5 nanomoles per liter, which is, for reference, the
previous level was 10 nanomoles per liter. So it was half as much testosterone. And she would have to do that via medication, which a lot of folks have said is medically unnecessary treatment for her. So she could do that in order to compete in the 800 meter and possibly also the 1500 meter. Or she could choose to compete outside of that and see what the IAAF chooses to do. It's worth noting that last week she competed in the South African Championships in the 5,000 meters and won. So she might choose to do that, and we'll see how the IAAF would respond to such a thing.
One of the things that we've been talking about, as we're talking about this, it just feels like there's a level of scrutiny that's been on this particular athlete that we don't see in other athletes. And what I mean by that is that there are natural genetic differences that can play a part in an athlete's success. We see Michael Phelps, for example, who is very, very tall and has very, very long arms and legs, and that's exactly what makes him, I think, do what he does best. How do you take why do you think, Katie, that Castor is being so scrutinized right now?
I think it's impossible to separate the intersection of sexism and racism in this particular case. It is worth noting that the two most high-profile women who have been having these conversations with the IAAF and have taken the IAAF to the Court of Arbitration for Sport have both been women of color. Judy Chand in 2015, an Indian sprinter, and then, of course, Castor Semenya. And Castor in particular, as I mentioned, has been targeted since she really burst onto the world scene in 2009. And largely, when you read reports from that time, it's very clear that people were pointing to her physique. And it's not dissimilar from criticisms about, you know, the way that Serena Williams looks, you know, pointing to black women's physique in particular.
And that making them unfair competitors, right?
Correct. That is insinuation that somehow because Castor Semenya is muscular and she improved by a significant margin over a short period of time, then that is good enough reason to call into question whether or not she is woman enough to compete against her competitors. And that is what has driven this conversation. And it's hard to not look at what's happening with Castor Semenya and think about the fact that, like, Katie Ledecky has absolutely dominated her competition for the entirety of her career, and not once has anyone ever thought to question her sex. And she set world records. Castor doesn't even hold the world record in the 800. And so that is something that I think is just inextricable from this conversation. It's just how sexism and then also racism play a very huge role here.
I want to talk a little bit also about how this ruling could impact trans athletes. You and I have talked about this issue in the past, and I'm wondering, trans women who might also have elevated levels of testosterone could be impacted by this, no?
Yeah. So these regulations for the 400 and the 800 and possibly the 1500 a mile as well require any athlete who wants to compete in those competitions or restricted events, as they're being called, to reach that 5 nanomole per liter threshold. And that includes transgender women. And so previously, transgender women, should they be on hormone therapy and going through a medical transition, if they hit 10 nanomoles per liter, that would be enough and they would be able to compete with women. But now that goalpost has moved considerably. And so that will be certainly a challenge. And it's worth noting that there are very few transgender athletes competing at the elite level, but underscoring not just like from a medical perspective what this means, but the precedent then of what this has said, which is that testosterone is the hormone that we should be most concerned about when it comes to athletic advantage. And that, culturally speaking, has the possibility to filter down through the elite levels all the way down to the conversations that we've had about youth and the access to sport for transgender girls and transgender women writ large.
Katie, what do we know, if anything, about the potential for side effects from this type of hormone suppression that's being asked of this athlete?
Everyone individually would respond to medication differently, but it is worth noting that the Court of Arbitration for Sport, in their ruling, did say that the IAAF, expressed concern about how this could be implemented and the possible side effects for these athletes, and basically said that should there be side effects and should athletes come back to the Court of Arbitration for Sport and prove that there are significant side effects and harm done to them medically, that the proportionate or the proportionality of this like discriminatory policy, which the Court of Arbitration for Sport did say it is a discriminatory policy, but that proportionality would be called into question and could then shift the tide back to rendering these regulations invalid.
Katie Barnes writes about sports and culture for ESPNW. Katie, thanks so much for your insights.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
And that's our show for today. But if you missed anything, like our big look at the intersection of infrastructure spending and racial inequality, you can always go back and listen to the Takeaways Daily podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.